Omaha Public Radio presents a special program for National Holocaust Remembrance Day on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Reverend Carl Wilkins, former head of the Adventist Development and Relief Agency International in Rwanda. He'll speak on the topic, Eyewitness to Genocide, Journey to the World Outside My Shoes, Focus on Courage and Trust. Reverend Wilkins' appearance is co-sponsored by the Countryside Community Church Center for Faith Studies and the Institute for Holocaust Education. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday evening, March 15, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, the Institute for Holocaust Education, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Beth Selden Dotan, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education.
In 1994, Reverend Carl Wilkins, former head of the Adventist Development and Relief Agency International, was living in Rwanda with his wife and family. Nicholas Kristof tells us in a 2004 New York Times article that U.S. officials and church leaders ordered Mr. Wilkins to join an emergency evacuation of foreigners from Rwanda, and relatives and friends implored him to leave, but he refused. Miss Wilkins and the children left, but Reverend Wilkins insisted on staying in Kigali to try to protect his Tutsi friends. His father warned him that even if he survived, his insubordination might end his career in the church. In the end, every other American left Kigali, but Reverend Wilkins remained through the entire genocide. It seemed just the right thing to do, he acknowledged. While sharing experiences of what day-to-day life in Rwanda was like during the genocide, Reverend Wilkins focuses on the courage and resilience he witnessed with the people facing horrendous choices in the middle of unimaginable slaughter. Reverend Wilkins asks, if we really do believe what we see, or is it more often that we see what we believe? His story reminds us of the profound connection between history and the moral choices we face each day. It also armed us with a new insight in the fight against genocide, along with the tools and inspiration for reevaluating the relationships we are part of every day. It is my honor tonight to introduce Reverend Carl Wilkins to you tonight, who through his own experiences will put a human face on genocide, showing us that the perpetrators, victims, and resistors will not soon be forgotten. Reverend Wilkins.
Thank you. Boy, this is a gorgeous evening. It'd be nice to be outside, huh? When I left, flew out of Spokane this morning, I called my wife from Denver and she said it's snowing. And I heard here it was 7 degrees last week or something. What a wild world we live in. Some of you I see here too from school and stuff. I think that's the school. Were those special tickets up there, or it's just always more fun? Always more fun to sit in the balcony, huh? I'm there. I know what that's like. When I was in high school, I had no plans to go to college. I did not want to go to college. I liked working with my hands, and my parents finally, a little arm twisting, said, well, go for at least 2 years. And so I studied industrial ed, auto mechanics, welding. And after 2 years of college, I went to Africa for a year. I'd always wanted to go to this mysterious continent. I'd read stories as a kid about Africa, and I spent a year in the Transkei. Some of you are very familiar with South Africa, back in 1978, 79. Still deep in the years of apartheid. And it just fell deeply in love with the continent. Came back, decided, yeah, I'll go to more college. And I got my degree as a high school auto mechanics and shop teacher, welding, all that good stuff. And went back to Zimbabwe, which of course has its own tragic story now. But went back there in 1981 with my new bride of only 6 weeks. I wish Teresa was here this evening for you to meet her. I'll show you a couple of pictures. But hers is quite an amazing story that still inspires me. And our first two children were born in Zimbabwe, our girls. The first one, in fact, the Zimbabwean ladies came and told my wife, now that you have a baby, you'll not be lonely anymore. It doesn't matter whether your husband's home or not. You have a child. And they gave her the name Sitoko Zili. And then after 6 years, came back to the States, got an MBA, and with that business technology combination, went to Rwanda, this land of 1,000 hills. So, in fact, Rwanda, tiny little country, only 100 miles by 100 miles, and yet the most densely populated country in Africa. We moved there in the spring of 1990. But I'd like to back up with you just a little bit. Some of you, this will be easier than for others. Some of you have some memories of the late 50s. I'm not sure what those memories of the late 50s would be. I'm sorry, if I was looking at you, I was just guessing maybe you might have some memories of the late 50s. Or that 57 Chevy when that came out, what a sweet car that was, huh? You know, and it's interesting to me to look at pictures from the late 50s and even go back in the 40s or the 20s or things like that, and then look at Africa during that time period, and it almost seems like a different planet. But for a moment, just imagine if we're looking at this hillside in the these multiple hillsides in 1959, okay? I was born in 57, so you can do the math there. I know I'm over 50, but I would have been 2 years old, and there was another little two-year-old boy, too. He senses the fear in his mother. She's holding his hand. She's taken her two boys and her three girls outside because she's not going to meet death in her own home. She's certain that they are about to meet their death as neighbors are being killed. 1959, neighbors are being killed, and the homes that spot the hillsides here and stuff, they've all got grass roofs at that time, and they're like torches lighting up the sky, just woofing up the sky. And then a very strange thing happens for 1959 in Rwanda. Just before these men with machetes and other hand weapons reach their hillside, a car comes along the road. If you can imagine a car, 1959, it's driven by the chauffeur of the king. And the chauffeur calls and whisks this mother and her five children into the car, out of harm's way, literally while people are running after there, ready to take their lives. It's a very dramatic story. In fact, it, of course, continues on. You see, if we were to talk, and we might during the question and answer time, a little bit about Rwanda and the two groups of people in the country, Hutus and Tutsis. I'm sure many of you saw Hotel Rwanda. That's opened the door, so to speak, or a little window for many, many people. And we try to figure out when we analyze these conflicts, or, you know, in the former Yugoslavia or different places in Ireland, who's the good guys and who's the bad guys, you know? We're always trying to figure this out. And some people say, Hutsi and Tutu, or what are they called, and who are these people? And what I'd like to share with you is that many of the kids, and even into their teen years and stuff in Rwanda, didn't know if they were Hutu or Tutsi background. The majority were Hutu. The minority, 15%, were of Tutsi. But they had married together. Oh, my, there were so many more Hutu and Tutsi marriages than you'd find, like, say, cross-racial marriages in America. Speaking the same language, the same religion, worshiping in the same churches, drinking, sharing beer together, very much mixed together. But somewhere back there in the past, they had sort of come from different areas. And back there during that time when the Belgians took over from the Germans and they saw the Tutsi people kind of thinking and acting, maybe a little more assertive, like their way of get her done, you know, the Western philosophy, all about efficiency and things like that, not so much about community. They were favoring the Tutsi people until this problem I'm talking to you about in 1959, when independence is coming to the whole continent and people realize, you know, this minority in power isn't going to fly. Some Hutus had actually gone out to work outside the country and stuff. As they came back, it was a transition. And in this transition time, as the Belgians now were favoring the Hutu more than the Tutsi, you had these revenge and this killing. And you got this little two-year-old. Remember I told you, the little guy standing there holding his mom's hand, fleeing with his mom and dad, brothers and sisters now, to the country to the north, Uganda. And there in Uganda, even though it's against horrible odds, as a refugee, you know, it's like, you don't belong. We don't really need you in our school. We don't need you in our country. This whole sense of not, man, that's like the basic thing we all want, is a sense of belonging. When you come to a new school, when you come to a new community, when you come to a new job, you come to a new church, this sense of belonging and feeling like you do not belong here. We'd be better off without you. That kind of mentality. But still, the kid excelled in primary school. Stellar. But then he hit high school. You know, sign of that high school dive? Kind of happens all around the world, it seems, at times. When you're just wondering, what in the world is the, what am I? What's my purpose? All those. But anyway, I won't go into his full story except to say that he and a friend join a rebel group, help put a new power into Uganda, new leader into Uganda, and they begin their training. And many of these Rwandans who fled in 1959-60, even if, through the 60s, are forming this organization called the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front. For 30 years, they try to come back by peaceful means. You're not welcome. This country's already densely populated. We don't want you. You left because you're troublemakers. And in the fall of 1990, just 6 months after we arrived in the country, they launch an attack. They take a battalion of soldiers, actually. It's pretty interesting reading in Stephen Kinzer's book, Land of a Thousand Hills. And this battalion of the Ugandan military is actually all made up of Rwandans. And it's Independence Day, not a strange day to be moving soldiers for some celebration or some function. And they get to the border of Rwanda and they're told, men, rip off your Ugandan army patches. You are the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And they launch an attack on this tiny little country, 100 miles by 100 miles. And they are smashed. As the Rwandan military counters their attack, and the French military, who's been training and sustaining the Rwandan military along, reinforces that, they're smashed. And this kid, Paul, who was on that hillside, it's significant, I'm telling you that for a reason. This kid, Paul, who had gone up in the Ugandan military, is now in training in Kansas. Military training school in Kansas. The leader of their RPF is killed in the second, third day. Still some question around his death. Looks like this movement is going to be squashed like that. And they tap this man on the shoulder here in Kansas. He takes his new bride, who I think was pregnant, to the UK, picks up a briefcase of $80,000 in cash, and sends his wife to Belgium as he heads down and actually eventually rebuilds, restructures this Rwandan Patriotic Front. Takes the guys to the volcano areas of Rwanda. Those places, Gorillas in the Mist, I can with this audience, you'll remember that film, and Diane Fossey and her work, and there in that volcanic mountain land, they rebuild the Rwandan. All of this is background that my wife and I have no idea of. We've just come to what we think is one of the most peaceful little countries in Africa, land of a thousand hills, and 6 months later, we wake up to gunfire in our town. This three-year war that's been going on now has come to our town. Three-year war is beginning here in October 1990, and it doesn't, of course, don't know at that time it's going to be a three-year war. I'm obliged to pause there because in the western part of the Sudan today, a genocide is going on. This genocide that they're calling like Rwanda in slow motion. Several hundred thousand people. How do I even say several hundred thousand? How can you say that so casually, huh? But as home after home after home, people have been killed or slaughtered. They're in refugee camps there now. And if you'd like to read more, as I'm sure some of you have done already, but a very interesting read about what's going on there from the perspective of a young man, it's called The Translator, Daoud. He uses his English to take reporters across the border from Chad, in the back door, into Sudan, taking people across the border, reporters, hoping that if the international community knows, they'll do something. You know, who is this international community? What part do I play in this international community? But it's an excellent read. In his shirt pocket there, he would have a cell phone. And on his cell phone would be, like in many places in Africa today, and on his cell phone would be all the numbers of rebel leaders of the area. If he was coming to Omaha, say, for example, bringing reporters, he'd be calling whoever the rebel leader is in charge of Omaha or one section of Omaha, getting permission to come into that section of Sudan, and then he would take these reporters in. It's a very, very fascinating read from the perspective of a young man who grew up there, whose camel, he said, was smarter than most people he knew, One night when his camel was stolen, he marched the thief around in circles for all night long. So the next morning, the thief was easy to track, and they caught him. His father then went and found the thief's father and made him pay some small animals for stealing the camel, and that's how Daoud got his first pair of shoes. And so you just read about life, about camels. When it comes time to war, he talks about the camels grinding their teeth. And when people, the sound of war, it's a new, and when people come home from this, and everybody's wondering, will my husband make it back? Will my son make it back? And those who don't make it back from war, the other warriors spend a couple weeks in their little home enclosure, telling stories, processing, helping through. This whole sense of community throughout the continent of Africa is phenomenal, which is what makes it so hard to understand how, if community was so phenomenal, you could actually eventually have neighbor betraying neighbor. Not all. Rarely is it all. There's usually one or two or three or four or even more significant numbers, but not often the majority, who don't go with the crowd, who don't flow right with the crowd when they recognize they could turn left. I want you to visualize that night in April 1986. Sorry, 1994, when the president was returning from Tanzania, coming back in his little Learjet, which was a gift from the president of France. You know, it's interesting. You just don't get jets every day as a gift. It speaks of a relationship, a long-lasting relationship. It speaks of certain intimacies, of understandings, and of working together. In the cockpit, there was a French pilot, a French co-pilot. It surprises me to no end that this plane that was shot down, two surface-to-air missiles launched, or perhaps RPGs, one of them finding their target, the plane crashing just on the side of the runway, going up and blowing up in flames, killing everybody on board, the president of Rwanda, the president of Burundi, and of course this flight crew from the airport. We heard the explosion at our house, just 8 miles away. And my father actually was visiting at the time, and he commented on it. And he says, "My, that was loud, Carl." And I was like, "Yeah, we were used to having mortar grenades go off, gunfire. You see, democracy had come to Rwanda. Several years earlier, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, had imposed this multi-party system. We will not continue funding a country of just one political party. And so we had overnight many political parties. And for many people, democracy simply meant an absence of law. Thievery increased and violence increased in the country. And so it wasn't a real shock to hear that explosion, but it was only about probably 45 minutes later when we actually heard on the news that it was the president's plane that had been shot down. What surprises me, what I was saying earlier about that French crew, is why the government of France did not come in with their forensic scientists to investigate this plane crash, unless they were somehow keeping their distance for some, because they were very much involved with the military of that country, very much involved with the government there, and their own citizens dying besides the president and others. But till today, their people are still trying to speculate on who shot the plane down. But what had happened was the previous 2 years, there was this 3-year war, the previous 2 years, they had been planning this genocide. It's almost as if they put explosive around the country, you know, like dynamite. They say you can kick dynamite and nothing happens. I mean, it doesn't sound like a smart thing, but it needs a detonator. And this shooting down of the president's plane was that detonator, because within 45 minutes, they began killing. Roadblocks were put up around the city, and some of the first people in our neighborhood, the harder one for me, is to think about those who were conceived during the genocide. Thinking about mom, who during those 9 months of that first movement of the baby, the birth, and yet knowing that this pregnancy comes from the multiple nights, perhaps, or days of being violated and at the same time infected with AIDS. Many moms today in Rwanda growing weaker as their kids grow stronger. And when they're born, it's like, this child is me. It's my flesh, and yet it's not. Perhaps some facial features of faces that are burned into her memory that she will never forget. The courage to move forward. They'll tell you that it's one thing to survive the killing. It's another thing to survive the survival. What is it like those days and years following? You think about little kids and saying, you know, this guy must be part goat, and the humor of a child and stuff, and yet realizing that they're growing up in a society that has just been shredded, destroyed beyond any, Kinzer in his book, A Thousand Hills, starts the story with the president of Somalia visiting the president of Rwanda. Oh, I don't think I finished that story, huh? That boy who was standing by his mother in the hillside and tapped on the shoulder, came back and rebuilt the RPF and is today the president of Rwanda. Paul Kagame. The reason I said it's significant, during the time of the genocide on hate radio, they were saying, we must kill them all this time. Do not spare even the kids. If we'd have done our job right back in 1959, we wouldn't have had this group to deal with today. This final solution, you know, that kind of thinking. In fact, I ask students, it's kind of a strange question, but I'm trying to help us, how do we, in the comfort and the security of our country, how do we begin to put ourselves in the place of these neighbors, these global neighbors of ours? And I'll often ask students, you know, this is a terrible question, but hang with me for a minute. If somebody told us that our neighborhood would be better without three of these kids, which three would you get rid of? Now, see, I told you, it's a terrible question. But, of course, you probably know where I'm going with this question. And usually when I ask that, you know, come on, the neighborhood is going to be better if we get rid of three. Will we get rid of the three wearing blue? Will we get rid of those who are barefoot? Who will we get rid of to make this neighborhood better? You know, and obviously, You have no answer to that. At least I'd hope not. Except for one day on Long Island, 7th and 8th graders, so unpredictable. And one little guy raises his hand. You know, these rhetorical questions, we do not want. I said, yes. He says, the tall one in the back. I'm like, why? Tall kids pick on me, he said. I go, wow. That's his role. And then you know what? Another kid raised his hand. Look what that. When one stood up, another kid raised his hand. I'm like, oh, shoot. Yes? The one with his arms crossed. Why him? He looks like a bully. And all of us, looking through our own lens, we look at things, and even with minimal information, I was so happy the next day. I almost didn't do that exercise again, you know? I'm like, is this even ethical? But the next day, I asked a similar group. They were just from different schools in Long Island, same age group. No, it was quiet. I'm like, good, but I have to push this a little bit. So I walked among them, and I said, come on, three. Now, these are 7th or 8th graders. I'm the visiting lecturer. They've been brought to this place to hear this guy talk about the genocide. Now he's telling them three, and nobody's answering. And a little blonde-haired boy, you know, with wild curly hair over on the left, raises his hand. I'm like, oh, shoot, I shouldn't have pushed so hard. You know what I mean? But the little guy, I said, yes. And he says, none of them. Now, this would have been a good place to stop, but I sometimes don't know when to stop. And so I said, no, that's not an option. I said, we need three. And I turned away from him, and I looked at the other side. Nobody raised their hand. I looked back, and the little guy's got his hand up again. And I said, okay, which one? And he says, none of them. And I said again, you see, you never know how far. I said, no, that's not an option. But the third time when I turned back and he raised his hand again, you know, and he says, none of them. I go, wow, thank you. You are growing up knowing that you always have a choice. Irregardless if the authorities, if the gray-haired guy who's lecturing to you at school or someone else tells you these are your choices, you know that you always have a choice. Imagine that. You see, because the genocide in Rwanda wasn't just some gray-haired guy. It was the police. It was the government. It was the radio. It was the radio that you'd listened to for years had told you everything you ever wanted to know about the country, about obituaries, about employment ads at 3 o'clock, and the radio was it. And when people of authority tell you to do things, and you do them, thinking, well, that's what they said to do, horrible things can happen when we don't think for ourselves, when we don't realize we always have. Viktor Frankl, in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, you know, survivor there in the Holocaust, he says, we always have a choice. Even if it's a choice of how we're going to suffer, we have a choice. And you've seen it, huh? Oh, this sucks, you know. And somebody else says, no, wait a minute, we can do this, you know. It's all the same situation, but different attitudes. We always have a choice. That's why I have a very simple definition of genocide, or at least a few thoughts on genocide. I believe that genocide stems from thinking that says, my world would be better without you in it. You and your kind. And you look at that and you begin to examine those phrases. And you see one of the biggest problems there. I mean, there's tons of problems, but you see one of the biggest problems that's there is this little phrase, my world, you know. Please tell me, where's my world? It's this fantasy that's just right here between my ears. This fantasy does not, my world is just an imaginary place. So if we change that to our world would be better without you in it. Well, when did you stop being part of our world? Our world, my world, your world. I don't know. Do you ever think of that? Get that jerk off the highway. You know, we'd be better off without. And those kind of exclusive solutions are temporary at best and genocide at worst. Exclusive thinking. What's the inclusive? What's the inclusive? The other side. The plane is shot down. The French soldiers arrive. They're not there to stop the genocide. They're there to take the foreigners out. Wednesday night, the plane is shot down. Thursday, we're hearing this terrible banging, this pounding, this slamming and slamming and slamming. And it's not just somebody hitting on the end of a bench like this, but it's people trying to break into houses, breaking through metal doors. Mom and dad in that house, three houses down, have hid themselves in a closet underneath the stairway. They have pitched their young children over the fence into the yard of this house next door, which was an orphanage. I didn't know it at the time. Our kids knew all about our neighborhood there. We'd lived there for 4 years, but I didn't. I you know, if they were in trouble at nighttime and knock on our door, sure, we'll take them to the hospital or help how we can, but our kids were building relationships throughout this time. And so those children that were pitched over the fence survived. I'm not sure what happened to the young teenage boy who burrowed into a pile of brush. But mom and dad had their lives taken from them. And their lives were taken from us too. You know? Their lives were taken from them. Their lives were taken from us too. And that night, unbeknownst to us, they came to our gate. They came back to our house. And as they came to our gate, they were not armed with guns. They had no guns, not even with machetes. They were armed with something much more powerful. This just kind of blows me away. They were armed with stories. You see, a gun never ends a fight, huh? It just ratchets it up to another level, you know, and this thing, one other. But a story has this potential. We all have a story. Nobody can ever take us. We can be locked up in a cell. Nobody can take our story from us. We always have our story with us. Our story is that ability to connect one with another and another story. These neighbors came with simple little stories. You know what they said? But you know what their stories were? Their stories were simply, their kids play with our kids. You can't go in. First thing they said was, these people aren't Belgians, because initially they were blaming the Belgians for shooting the plane down. And then they just said, these kids play with our kids. Their kids play with our kids. At night, little acts of kindness. They'll take us to the hospital. Little. Can you imagine how significant those little acts of kindness became for us? 4 years of living in the neighborhood, 4 years of me not building relationships with my neighbors, but thank goodness, our kids building relationships with our neighbors. 4 years. At minimum, they would have come in and robbed our house. We would have seen them walking down the street carrying, the furniture out, just like they'd been carrying the furniture out of the house of the neighbors and stuff. But at worst, they would have been doing to Mindy and Lisa and Sean what they were doing to other Mindy, Lisa's, and Sean's, or my wife, Teresa, what they were doing to others in the neighborhood. And so we had a decision to make come Friday as the embassy was giving us this ultimatum, it's time to evacuate. I'd been meeting at the embassy office every other week. We had these town meetings. I was kind of like, they said, a warden for a group of missionaries. And we had assembly points. I don't know your city well enough, but you could probably identify several landmarks in the city. If we had to have assembly points in times of crisis, here's where people come and meet. And not only the soldiers came, but also the television crews. In this documentary, Ghost of Rwanda, it was on PBS Frontline, 2004. You'll see this lady interviewed as she's there to just simply cover it, but she comes face to face with another lady, with a Rwandan lady. All of a sudden, the camera is no longer a barrier between the two, and this lady is pleading with her, take us. Take us away from here. And the television lady says, it's woman to woman now. I didn't think we could do anything. As they all left, they came, they were at a mental hospital, they took the foreigners away. And as they left these people behind, they heard the gunshots, they heard the explosions. They knew that these people were being killed. And as she's being interviewed later, they ask, what? Tell us, what? Why didn't anybody do anything? She says, at the moment, she has this little bit of an accent, seems to give it a certain depth. At the moment, she says, we didn't think we could do anything. Well, the interviewer asked a little further. She says, but somebody has to decide, she says. Somebody has to decide. And had those somebodies made certain decisions, these hundreds of thousands of people would not have been killed. So as the soldiers are coming and evacuating the foreigners, my wife and I have to make a decision. There's a young lady who'd been working for us for 3 years in our home. I kind of stop at this time of genocide trying to describe people as Hutu or Tutsi. I think it's important to say people whose ID card said Hutu or people whose ID card said Tutsi. Because that was the determining factor whether you lived or died. And this young lady here in our home who worked for us, the children loved her. She was so gentle and wonderful with the children. Her ID card said Tutsi. She very much put a face. It wasn't just simply these people who'd be killed. It was Tabit who would be killed. It was Emalba, this young man, his ID card said Tutsi, who would be killed. And this decision that Teresa and I made, it wasn't a decision I made and asked her to go along with. It was a decision we both really made together. We both shared a common love. And I think it's that crazy thing called love. It's those crazy wild cards, trump cards called relationships that really drive some of the most powerful experiences we become. We have a part, a role in playing. And so when I said goodbye to Teresa and the kids, I said, 2 weeks love, 2 weeks maximum. And this thing can't go on. Can you imagine it going on and on? Those of us who, we all, in fact, even our students will remember 9/11, though you may have been quite young. Many of us remember it very freshly. And we remember, at least, I don't know if it was for you, but for me, the next day when I turned on the TV, I was hesitant. I didn't know what we might see the next day. If you could imagine this 9/11 not being the phrase now, because it wasn't just 9/11, it was 9/12. And we saw 6,000 people killed in Atlanta. 9/13 and 7,000 people killed in Chicago. 9/14 and 5,000 people killed in Denver. 9/15, and it sounds kind of tedious. How far is this guy going to go, And 7,000 people killed in San Francisco. 9/16, and 8,000 people killed in Minneapolis. 9/17, but for 100 days in Rwanda, Those were the numbers. See, Rwanda isn't just an examination of how terrible and how horrible humanity can be. But it's also an examination and a question and a study and how we can turn our backs. And please, this is not some sort of a guilt thing where I'm trying to say America's supposed to be the policeman of the world or anything like that. But we have to know that every situation we find ourselves in is an opportunity. And every opportunity demands a decision. And doing nothing is a decision. The people from CNN were there with their cameras. The people from BBC were there. I spent 88 nights in my hallway listening to that radio, wondering if sometime someone is going to... I heard Nixon die. I heard Nelson Mandela be released from prison, waiting to hear something to happen in Rwanda. It was 3 weeks before I could even get out of our home because the only ones allowed on the streets at that time were those who were doing the killing. And finally, after 3 weeks, the government announced on the radio that anyone who had some legitimate reason to be out could come out and get a laissez-passer, a permissions, you know, document allowing you to drive around. And that's when I met the colonel who was in charge of the city. His ID card said Hutu. He said to me, "Carl, if you're ever going to make a difference, you've got to form relationships with those who are in power. It's not about whether they have blood on their hands or not. It's about forming relationships with those in power." Now, that's a whole discussion we could have there in terms of who we interact and who we don't. But suffice it to say that I went to the government headquarters and I told the colonel, Renzaho, who was later tried in Arusha. His trial ended about a year ago, at least, but I haven't heard the judgment yet. But there in Tanzania, these war crimes, these genocide tribunals, and being charged with responsibility for the death of thousands of people. But I became friends of sort with Colonel Renzaho. I said the radio's announcing that all the aid organizations have left, but I want you to know I haven't. They said everyone except the Red Cross has left. I said, ADRA is still here. I was there as the director of the Adventist Development Relief Agency. It was the humanitarian branch of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. You know, as I mentioned earlier, this background with technology and then business, it kind of seemed like a good combination to go and do that humanitarian development relief work. "How can I help?" I asked. And he put me in touch with one of his team who took me to several orphanages around the city, and that's where I started my work of trying to find food and water at these orphanages. Before I tell you about the orphanage, though, I have to tell you about my wife and children. They went first to Burundi. Burundi became too unstable, and then they went to Nairobi. And my wife, every day, the first, I'd say, about 6 weeks of the genocide, would walk downtown Nairobi, this busy city there in Kenya, and she'd go to the embassy office where they had a high-frequency radio. I had one in my home. I never knew at the time, you know, we're in this little country, remember, 100 miles by 100 miles? That's we'd talk radio around that country. I never knew that radio, that little wire on the ridge of my house roof would take a signal 1,000 miles away to Nairobi, where I could talk to her in the embassy, and she would go back into the, what do they call that area where you need special clearance to get back there in the communications section, and she would call 76, this is Tango Whiskey, 76, do you call? I was 76, she, Teresa Wilkins, Tango Whiskey. And we would talk. We would talk sometimes for hours. One day I said, "You know, love, I think we're talking now more than when we lived together." I never knew what a strong woman I was married to. I never knew what a courageous woman I was. I knew she was wonderful. I'd fallen in love with her. We'd been in Africa for 10 years by this point. 2 children born there, another one born back here in the States. But there's so much you don't know until certain situations come around. For the kids, she made it seem more like an adventure than an ordeal. You know, she would find someone to watch over the kids as she would then come downtown, sometimes walking downtown. Other times she would be taking a taxi. I was just blown away. This sense of I have all the time. You know, I'm the one who's always like, "Oh, come on, we got to hurry here." You know what dads, and when they take vacation trips and it becomes a road race, you know what that's like? Will you guys get out in the car? When are we ever going to leave? Hey, we're taking too much time, and it's all about, you know, hurrying up and get this done and all. This ability to give somebody the freedom to know that you value them and they have time. She's wonderful in so many ways like that. You know, there's a love. A lot of people have said, and I can appreciate this because they're asking themselves, and that's what's important. They're saying, I don't know if I could leave my husband in a situation like that. Often we're given the idea that love, the best, the most powerful love, never lets go. But then you find out in certain situations that actually it takes an even greater love to trust and to let go. She would tell you if she was here this evening that she'd say, I'm not a naturally brave person. She'd say, but during that time, I was given a special gift. She would then go back, find the kids, do homeschool with them, maybe take them across the road to the little hotel, take them swimming. And then she'd be on the phone trying to locate some couple tons of powdered milk to try to ship in to me. And I am such a, never knew what a good choice. I'm married right. This orphanage here is in the worst section of the city during the time of killing, Gasimba Orphanage. As I came in the driveway that first day, there were fresh little graves on the left as you came in. They weren't from those who'd been killed. You see, this is surrounded by homes all around here. And as people were being killed, children would flee to the orphanage as a haven. In fact, as I was back there this last summer, I met a young man who's just graduated from law school. His folks had, like my neighbors in the little orphanage near our home, had boosted him over the hedge probably at about 8 years of age. Maybe he was 9. He lived. His whole family died. Today he's an attorney. You wouldn't believe if you saw the big smile on his face. And you just stand there and you hear this young man say, thank you. And you're like, wow. If for just one, it would have been so worth it. Just these kids who've written, some of them have written thank yous. And one little kid said, thank you for bringing us water. They would line up with the little metal cups. Seriously, for one mug of water. Maybe for 2 days, that's all they would get to drink. You see, they didn't have enough water to drink, much less wash up. The kids were dying of dysentery, diarrhea. That's why when I came in the gate, those little graves there were from little ones who were dying from diarrhea. Thank you for bringing water, he said. Another little kid says, you know, thank you for helping us. Maybe one of us one day will discover the cure for cancer. You don't know. You don't know. We are irreversibly tied and connected to one another's destiny and future. This gentleman, his name is Amiel. He was my administrative assistant while we were there. We were building schools, I don't know if I told you, operating health centers. Then we were working in refugee camps during the war. This man was invaluable. He spoke like 5 different languages. One day when the war just started, we were distributing some used clothes to people. If you can imagine the middle of the night, bombs are falling and moms are waking kids up trying to evacuate. They didn't know the fighting would get that close that fast. And they're fleeing in the dark with nothing but the clothes on their back. And they end up in a school and hoping, little kids, mom, when can we go home? And, you know, honey, I don't know. Maybe soon. And many of them, 2-3 years in these refugee camps. Some of them as large as 60,000 people in these areas. And Amiel would work in these camps. This day they were distributing clothes. And as they were heading back to the little town where they were going to spend the night, riding in the back of a large open truck, he saw from his vantage point in the truck a field with a crowd of people. And he started hitting on the roof. Stop, stop, he said, as the driver screeched to a stop. He jumped out of the truck, ran, pushed through the crowd, because from his vantage point, he could see past it. A little guy in the middle was just rolling and rolling on the ground. And this little guy was being swarmed by bees. Amiel is just like, it's just reflex. He just runs through the crowd, scoops the little guy up, bees and all, turns back, runs towards the truck, hands him to the young 19-year-old Danish volunteer, Pia, who's in the back of the truck there. Here, she gives him this boy and bees and all. Go, go, he shouts at the driver, who then takes off, and Amiel's only halfway in, falls back as the truck lurches out of there and hits his head, is knocked unconscious. He comes to maybe just a minute or so later. His head is covered with bees. The Pia, who's swatting, trying to get the bees off the boy, all of a sudden notices there's no Amiel. Stop the truck. And the truck stops again, turns around, go back. They pick him up. They drop a wheel in the ditch. They're stuck. If Amiel was here, he'd tell you, nobody came to help us. And when there's nobody else, he says, my maker got us out of that ditch. And by the time they got to this little African hospital, Amiel's unconscious. That poison is just, you know, the anaphylactic shock. And fortunately, they had epinephrine. You know, they had what was needed. And Amiel lived. I called them on the radio. They're telling me what happened. I said, well, come on back. No, Amiel says, the Red Cross needs our truck to distribute food tomorrow. They have food, but not enough vehicles. I'm like, but you are all, I understand, you look terrible. I mean, you're all swollen in the bees. No, I'll be fine. All the next day, he sits in the cab of this truck, bouncing over the rough road. For him, it's never about him. It's always about the other. He gets back that night and comes to the office, and I go, I hug him, and I hold him back. I'm like, you look terrible. His eyes swollen shut, big lumps on the side of his head. He says, you know, Mr. Director is what he always called me. You know, Mr. Director, I was going to have a bee project at home, a honey project. I don't think I'm going to do that now, he says, you know. He lived about 25 kilometers outside of town. Beautiful. He planted a big eucalyptus forest all around his home. Beautiful plants. Anytime he was around the country, whether we were on an agriculture project, a refuge or whatever, he'd see a plant he didn't have. He'd cut a little slip, put it in a plastic bag, stick it in his pocket, you know. And just this kind of person who collected stray people, kind of like many people collect stray cats. He's just an amazing man. When I was in Zaire with him at one point, he was talking to some people there one day that was trouble. We were doing an assessment mission, and we're laying in the guest room that night about to go to sleep. I said, Amiel, what was that language you were talking? He says, oh, that's Lingala. I said, well, did you used to live here? How do you? Nah, he says, I listened to their radio station. I'm like, what? You learn a language listening to a radio station? It's the very sharp. Very generous. He'd ride his bike to off work often, that 25 kilometers outside. His thighs were, the guy was fit, you know, up early, working in his garden, then in the office, and great typist and translator and all this stuff. Then the genocide comes. Amiel's ID card says Hutu. His wife's ID card says Tutsi. His ID card says Hutu because his dad's ID card said Hutu, but his mom's ID card said Tutsi. Amiel's face was more like his mom. He resembled his mom. Sometimes you could, because there was a lot of, but sometimes Tutsi people might have a little lighter skin. They might be a little taller. They might have a little finer features in their face. They talk about them coming from Ethiopia more. And Alice, though, her ID card says Tutsi, his wife. He goes to neighbors, asks, can Alice and the children hide here? You can see Margaret in the picture. Margaret was about 6 at the time. Adam was about 4. And neighbors did. It's not like, do you have an extra room? Do you have extra food in the cupboard? No. Are you willing to risk your life for someone else? Because if you're caught, more likely than not, you'll be killed. Not just you, but your wife and your children. It's one thing to risk your life. What about risking the lives of those who... You understand some of the dilemmas. But people open their home a day or two late. He'd come at night, try to come unobtrusively, bring a little food he'd found maybe down in the garden or something. Amiel, they call him aside. Listen, people know I'm sorry. You're going to have to find a new place. It's not a secret anymore. I understand. And he takes another home. Finally, they've got no other place. And they're at home when the militias came. He's there with his 2 small children. We just want to question your wife. And of course, he knows. He sees some other women. They've already gathered over there on the side. And no, we're not going to kill her. We're just going to... And how do you argue with someone about a life? And you've got your little 4-year-old and your 2-year-old. What kind of choices do you... You look at this man's face. You have no idea the choices he's had to make. As she was going down his driveway through the forest, it's the last time he saw her. The genocide comes to an end as the RPF eventually drives this genocidal government. Understand, this was almost like a coup. You see, the president is killed when the plane is shot down. The next day, they go to the prime minister's home and they kill her. Get that, her. Her ID card said Hutu, but they knew she wouldn't cooperate with the genocide. their plans. Their plans are, the only solution here is to get rid of these Tutsis. And at the same time, you know, we got all these political parties. Let's get rid of these moderates too, who are a pain in the neck. We'll just get rid of them all. That'll be our solution. And the RPF eventually, after they would lob, you saw our home there on the map, they would lob mortars over our home into the downtown section with such regularity that our African gray parrot would whistle like a mortar. Eventually, this evil, this cancerous thing, this genocide turns, I think, on itself and is destroying, and they flee. And as they flee, there's much killing in the wake. Amiel and his two little ones flee. Fortunately, they never get to Goma, where people started to die by the thousands from cholera. The international community, who had not really been willing to spend hardly a dime to stop the genocide, now pours millions and millions in to those who were, many of them, perpetrators of the genocide, this largest movement of refugees in the last century. In just a couple of days, maybe as many as 2 million people. Amiel doesn't make it there. He fortunately doesn't. He survives. He's coming back. I go hunting for him. It's kind of a long story, but I find him about 60 kilometers out of the capital. He's skinny. His kids have bug bites all over them, but I'm wrapping my arms around him. I can count his ribs, you know, and I'm like, Amiel, let's go home. And I have a truck that had been stolen from the UN, and it's kind of got its own story, but it's this double cab pickup. And Amiel, again, it's not about him. He says, please, these people I'm with, they're from my area. What? I said, I got a truck. Put them in. We can, you know, we can all go. And so he and his kids and his brother are in the front seat with me, and the back seat's full, and the bed is just starting to weigh down with people. And an older lady in the back calls out, Mzungu, Mzungu, Gwinahana, she says, come here. And she calls me. She can't hang on to the people and her plastic water jug at this. She hands me her water jug. So I'm driving out with my arm out the window holding a water jug in the truck. And we're not even gone far. And Emil says, wait, this little boy, he's from my area too, and he's sick on the side of the road. And I'm going, Amiel, where are we going to put him? And he looks around, he says, in the window. And so the little kid sits in the window as we're driving. By the time we got to his home, we had 8 people in the 4 windows. And we get to his home. And his home, this is not, I wish, you know, happy endings. I hope the forest has been cut down. People have built shelters around there trying to, it didn't surprise me. They may have come in his direction looking for refuge, but the shelters are full of the families where they lay, where they had been killed. The smell is there. The trees are all cut down. His home is completely looted, doors stolen from the hinges, and of course, no Alice. I wanted to take him home. No, no, no. He says, I'm fine. His parents had come back. His dad was like 90. His parents had somehow survived. This is my home. I'm fine, he says. I go back the next evening. We sit there under these stars, as you can imagine, in Africa. And this man speaks to me of faith. Like, if anybody has a reason to be angry, to be bitter, you know, suppose somebody gets in front of you at Starbucks, huh? Imagine they cut line, or they do something on the freeway, or, you know, these things we get so ripped off about. Oh, my favorite program was, if anybody has a reason, this, but he does not. He chooses to live looking for the good. He chooses to live for others. He eventually came to the States here. He's actually in Michigan now. I talked to him several years ago. I said, Amiel, he was excited, got a new job at the mental hospital, wonderful care to the people. And I said, Amiel, this is awesome what you're doing for them and stuff, but I'm thinking your gift with languages, your knowledge of Africa, and, you know, well, he says, I have been saving my money. You know, he's working 2 jobs before and stuff. Finally got enough money so he could bring Margaret and Adam here to the States. And he started this nonprofit. It's called Life Lifting Hands. He, when I saw him a couple months, it's for school fees. Kids who, for $250, orphan kids get a whole year of room, board, and tuition at high school. And as I saw him, here's his car. His car has the license plate. It says Africa on it. They're on the bumper, empowering people for poverty reduction. Africa-USA partnership, lifeliftinghands.org. And he says the newspaper here, he's in Kalamazoo, Michigan, the newspaper took a picture of my car. He said they like it. Would anybody have any idea as they see this man driving down the road what his story is? His spirit of giving and giving and continuing to give. He just emailed me this last week a whole ton of more pictures of pregnant cows that are distributed to families who are struggling. I'm sure, he says, if they can just get a cow, they'll get that one lift up and they'll... He's an amazing man. And amazing. And it's people like that that continue to just move me in ways that go deep. I have a little piece that I wrote. It's called Freedom. My wife's an incredible pianist. And she's not here. If she was, she'd be playing the piano. But I have a little music I'd like to share with you as we read this about freedom. It's so clear that we've been created for freedom. It's our birthright. Freedom to learn. Freedom to love and be loved. Freedom to serve. Our birthright. Stop and think about your happiest memories. Didn't they have something to do with exploring, learning? Weren't they somehow connected to serving? Serving without any thought of repayment. Serving without any thought of duty or obligation. Just the sheer joy of doing something you could do for someone else. The sheer joy. Or perhaps that memory's wrapped in a moment of being loved. Loved unconditionally. Especially when we know we don't deserve it. You see, freedom does not mean doing what we want. Getting what we want. Searching for what we want. That's how we lose freedom. That's how we end up labeling and trampling each other and losing sight of the image of God in each other. And tragically, eventually, trying to exterminate each other. You see, I believe freedom is discovered when we encounter the other, or freedom is threatened when we encounter the other. The choice is ours. And who is the other? Someone far away? Someone fascinating or repulsive, or maybe someone feared or someone longed for? And who are we the other to? Do I see the other as enriching my world, or do I see the other as spoiling my world? Is my world safer with the other, or would I sleep better knowing the other is far, far away? What would happen, huh? If I entered the other's world, if I sat silently with the other, if I staggered under the huge emptiness of the other's loss, if I was paralyzed by the other's fear, if I sobbed with the other, if I simply walked with the other, if I asked myself why the other attacks, hides, gives, takes, screams, is so secretive. Do I have the desire, the courage? Will I take the time to enter the other's world? I believe that every encounter is an opportunity, and every opportunity demands a decision. So once again, so clear we've been created for freedom, to learn, to love, to serve. And so that's the choice. I think that it really is discovered. It's exciting when we encounter the other. Thank you all very much for coming out this evening.
You've been listening to a special program for National Holocaust Remembrance Day on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Reverend Carl Wilkins, former head of the Adventist Development and Relief Agency International in Rwanda. He spoke on the topic, Eyewitness to Genocide, Journey to the World Outside My Shoes, Focus on Courage and Trust. Reverend Wilkins' appearance was co-sponsored by the Countryside Community Church Center for Faith Studies and the Institute for Holocaust Education. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday evening, March 15, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Beth Selden Dotan of the Institute for Holocaust Education for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.